Welcome to Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's bouncing back like some crazy prime ministerial Alan Partridge. Needless to say, we're having the last laugh. This time, the Conservatives are rumoured to be dusting off Boris Johnson to campaign in the fabled Red Wall. What could the simple common folk of Bassetlaw, Wakefield and Workington want to see more than the guy who lied to them last time round and then ran away before he could be punished? And why are the Tories so fixated on the Red Wall anyway? Many of the most hotly contested seats are deep within solid Tory territory, so why are they bothering to defend constituencies that actively hate them? Plus, in related matters, whatever happened to levelling up? A new Public Accounts Committee report can't find any compelling examples of what the flagship scheme has delivered, and only 10% of the £10.5 billion fund has actually been spent. So what was it all for? In the words of key immigration commentator John Lydon, ever get the feeling you've been cheated? Let's meet the panel. First up, hello to Time magazine journalist Yasmin Saran. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
And Ramadan Mubarak. You're always kind of fuzzy around this time of year, aren't you?
I am. You can kind of see me drifting slightly. We're about an hour and 15 minutes to sunset. We still got a bit of time. No, but thank you. I'm surviving.
You're doing your best. We'll hold you up. So it is congratulations to plucky underdog Vladimir Putin, who secured 87% of the vote in Russia's presidential election. Of course, the moaning minis of the West called it a pseudo-election and a sham, but they would say that, wouldn't they? However, there were acts of civil disobedience to be seen during the election. Do you think it's shown that Russia's perhaps a little bit more split than Putin wishes it was?
Definitely. I mean, I think, look, it was less of an election, more of a coronation. And it's actually funny if you look, I think it was 87% of the vote he purportedly won. In 2000, it was 53%. If you look at every kind of election that's happened subsequently, that percentage just goes higher and higher and higher. So one can only imagine what in 6 years' time.
120% of the vote.
That's going to go look like, yeah, like 150. Yeah. But yeah, we did see signs of disobedience. There were a number of Russians who heeded the calls of Yulia Navalny, the widow of Alexei Navalny, basically calling for Russians to stage a protest vote at noon on the 17th to kind of overwhelm the polling stations. Some people spoiled their ballots. But to the point of kind of, you know, why Putin does this, I mean, why do authoritarians crave the legitimacy of an election? I profiled Evgenia Karamurza, whose husband Vladimir, a dual British-Russian national, currently, now that Navalny's dead, I think the most high-profile political prisoner in Russia today. And what she told me was basically that, you know, he needs to have these elections because he doesn't want there to be any alternative, certainly any democratic alternative to him. And that's not just to the people of Russia. He also wants the world to think that as well. So I think that's why that was what this election was about.
So it's like an evolved version of the power lie. Everybody knows it's rubbish. Everybody knows it's bullshit, but he can still do it and stand there barefacedly.
Basically, yeah.
Also with us, we have a journalist who specialises in social affairs and our one-woman housing desk, Hannah Fern. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
So to everybody's amazement, Ofcom has found against GB News in their latest ruling. Two episodes of Jacob Rees-Mogg's show, three presented by S. McVeigh and Philip Davis, were not presented with due impartiality. All the channel has received is a slap on the wrist, no sanctions at all. But GB News has clutched its pearls off, saying it's deeply concerned. Ofcom is obliged by law to promote free speech and media plurality and to ensure that alternative voices are heard. Do they actually want judgments like this? Because it kind of shores up the idea that they are the alternative voice, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they love the idea of the kudos of being cancelled. That's what they thrive on. And they also, I think, fetishise the Fox News model, i.e., the American system where libel doesn't exist and you can basically say anything you want. And they'd love us to have a bit of that, even though we're absolutely the opposite. So this is their way of testing the system. And what I find really surprising is, why do MPs play along with this? You know, Ofcom is sort of toothless and pointless. Mm. And like you said, it's delivered nothing but a slap on the wrist. There's not even a fine. So what's the point of it? If it can't actually make something happen, it just delivers tellings off. Why does everybody just persist in nodding along? It's a frustrating system.
It certainly is. Completing the panel, it's journalist, author, and jonesing former vapor, Marie LeConte. How are you?
Hello. Do you have a fag?
Are you now looking around the table and everybody just looks like cigarettes, like on Father Ted? You know, we're all sort of changing.
So I've generally started noticing every single smoker on the street when right. I did not used to do that. So I feel like that quite sweet thing when you see in movies, like a woman is quite like broody and wants a kid and looks at all the prams. Like, that's me and tabs. That I'm looking at every smoker going,
But you're also looking into prams and seeing a lovely bouncing cigarette. But I want to ask you political things, Marie, because that's why you're here. So the latest,
Fine.
So the latest Conservative MPs to decide they don't fancy standing in what's probably going to be the Christmas Day election are former Chairman Brandon Lewis and Armed Forces Minister James Heapy. We are refreshing Conservative Home's list of who's not standing like it's the Glastonbury tickets page. Are these people just in a race to not be the next Portillo?
I think yes and no. I think the first thing, so especially you can get someone like Brandon Lewis, like he's been in cabinet before. It seems unlikely he'll be in cabinet again. You know, he's been an MP for quite a long time. He's done quite a lot of stuff. So why not kind of call it a day? And I think even James Heapy, I think, is quite a good bloke, but, you know, is a Minister of State. Maybe could have made it to cabinet, you know, maybe not. Who knows? Like, we don't and we'll never know. But I think so. I actually, do I have permission to have quite a spicy take?
Go on.
So I think lots of people look at all those MPs standing down, and especially the kind of like big and medium-sized beasts of saying, you know, well, back in the day, the House of Commons used to be full of politicians who'd been there for ages, had all this experience and, you know, and they were wise, etc. Why do they always leave? And then about, you know, two breaths later, they'll be like, well, of course, MPs should not be able to have any form of second job. And of course, they should do an incredible amount of kind of casework in the constituency and do every fucking fate and every little thing in the seat, and also should be in the Commons for every single vote and somehow speak in every debate. And they don't really see how those two things, you know, the reason why so many impressive, clever, accomplished people stayed in the Commons for decades was because no one really gave a shit what they were doing there. So they could afford to kind of come in and out and occasionally be like, oh, that's actually a debate I fancy, you know, taking part in. Then be like, actually, I'm going to go earn some money for a bit, like two
just
days a
go
week.
Go work for Raytheon for 2 days a week.
No, but generally, and I think that's fine if you decide, okay, but actually we do just want MPs, we're going to have super councillors and the rest of the time are tethered to the chamber. But in that case, you should accept they're probably not going to stay for very long, like probably 10, 15 years at most. Or you really want that experience on the green benches, etc. And then you accept that actually you probably need to keep them on a slightly longer leash. So that is my spicy take.
That's pretty
or
spicy.
Pay them more.
But I still, I think they get bored as well. And I get, you know, if you've been a Secretary of State, if you've been, you know, you've been in one of the great offices of state, being back to being a backbencher and having a whip, being like, can you come vote on this? And then generally maybe meeting some lobbyists in Portcullis House, you know, every other Tuesday. Like, that's not a fun life. Like, I think fair I do point. Get, I think it's not just the money. I think it's also doing other stuff.
I want to ask you one more thing before we move on to the main stuff. Penny Mordaunt as the extra time Prime Minister, let her go on for 5 minutes before the final whistle. What do you think about this, or what are you hearing about this install Mordaunt?
I think it's just that politics abhors a vacuum. Westminster abhors a vacuum, and there's nothing going on, like, legislation-wise. I think that the most important story, the most relevant story to that Penny Mordaunt stuff, is the story that came out recently that showed that Parliament is sitting less than this year than any other Parliament in the history of whatever. Like, again, weirdly coming back to what I was saying earlier as well, MPs are really bored because there's nothing going on. They don't really have a job at the moment, so what they're doing is gossiping. Like, I think that is literally it, and it should not sort of be taken seriously at all. Is just, you know, sort of like high school students starting to gossip when is the last week of school before the summer holidays.
So I'm never going to get to use my Mordaunt on the dance floor headline or my one does not walk into Mordaunt headline.
Nice.
God.
Maybe in opposition. We'll see.
Who knows?
Penny for her thoughts.
Before we start, a bit of news about our Patreon support drive, which is going really, really well. Last week, we asked people on the old £2 tier if they consider moving on up, like Curtis Mayfield, to the £3 tier. Not a lot for you, but a big difference to us. And we were really overwhelmed by the response. Loads of people did it. Thank you so much. And if you haven't done it yourself, why not join them? As we've explained a couple of times, there is a bit of a chill wind blowing through the podcast world right now. So we have to rely on your backing a little bit more than we used to. And we're very grateful for every spare penny that you can send. So if you're a Patreon backer and you can afford an extra £1 a month, less than the price of a Mars bar, then please consider going up a tier. Just go to memberships on your Patreon page and you can upgrade with one click, and we will love you for it. And if you're not a Patreon supporter at all, now is the time to join. We're going to have some live show news soon, and Patreon backers are always first to get early bird ticket access and a discount too. Follow the link in the show notes or search Patreon Oh God What Now. Every penny helps. Do you see?
Yeah.
Kind of blank. Yeah. Now, red wall, brown trousers. If you'd mentioned the red wall to most people prior to the 2019 election, they'd have stared at you blankly. Since then, The idea of a belt of Labour heartland constituencies across the North and the Midlands, which turned Tory for the first time in decades, or sometimes ever, and would stay that way, has become a political touchstone for the Conservative Party, proof that they changed Britain forever. But is the Red Wall about to be rebuilt? YouGov polling suggests that every one of those seats could go back to Labour in the next election. And why are the Conservatives wasting time and energy to protect its seats there, which often don't have the most scintillating MPs, instead of protecting under-threat constituencies right in its core regions? Marie, why did the Red Wall become so central to the Tory kind of, you know, identity self-myth over this parliament? Was it just a snappy phrase that kind of got over?
I think it was partially that. So I think at election time or in the kind of run-up to an election, there's always going to be some constituency people, you know, the papers talk about and MPs talk about. So, you know, Workington man, Mondeo man, was it a Worcester woman, etc. They love that so
much.
They're
always alliterative as well, aren't they?
They are. And I think, yeah, so we've moved on to Wool now.
Darlington dude kind of thing.
Because I like that, yeah, now we've got Wool. So obviously we've got the Red Wall, we've got the Blue Wall, we've got the Coastal Wall, we've got the etc. But yeah, no. I think the Red Wall is an interesting one because basically you have to think about the fact that that election happened in the aftermath of years of Brexit, kind of like psycho drama where everyone went mad. The Tories hated the Tories and were at war with the Tories against the Tories. And you know, and that happened and that was kind of meant to be the we're putting it all behind us kind of election. And they were in dire need of something to unite them again and something to give them an identity that felt cohesive, even if it wasn't actually cohesive, of saying, okay, fine, you know, we're done with, you know, there were the Cameroons versus the Brexiteers, etc. Are we putting all of this behind us? We're now the Red Wall, guys.
Yeah. Apparently it was coined by a researcher for UK and a Changing EU called James Kanagasuriam, and I wonder if he should have copyrighted it and sold merchandise like I should have done with Landfill Indie, you know, t-shirts and stuff.
I actually know James as it happens. He's a great guy, and I think it's mostly the fact that, you know, people are misusing what he meant. Like the Red Wall is actually voters who basically should have been Tory for quite a long time. So in bits of the North saying that actually they had quite Tory lives. So they'd bought quite a nice gaff. They had one or two like quite nice cars. They'd go on holiday, etc. So they had the lives of like traditional Tory voters. But because of like tribalism, because the Tories weren't really appealing to them for quite a long time, they were still Labour voters. What happened in 2019 was that they finally went, we're kind of more naturally at home with that lot. So it's really not people kind of like living hand to mouth in like left behind towns, etc. Like that's not what the Red Wall ever was.
The wonderful character of the North. Thanks, Marie.
We all live
in bins.
Yeah. No, but that's my point of saying that it's not that. It's actually people who have like quite nice lives.
Yeah.
We
do. We have lovely lives in the North. What do you think of the wisdom of sending Boris Johnson to campaign in the Red Wall? I mean, Dorry says it's not going to happen. Why would he want to save the backsides of MPs who've removed him as Prime Minister? How do you think he'd go across?
Probably not. Well, I think also one of those things that's worth mentioning is that this may seem obvious, but apparently it's not. Britain is smaller than the United States.
We can follow that up with Yasmin shortly.
Yeah.
I
don't know. Yasmin may know this.
She's
you know, it's quite
can
specialist.
Confirm.
But yeah. So, you know, it is geographically smaller and there are fewer people. No, but I think, as ever, like the way people talk about the Red, they kind of compare it to US politics and the kind of like the Rust Belt and the forgotten places and stuff. And it's like, again, England especially is really not that big. And actually, Red Wall voters, if you look at lots of data, are not massively different from the rest of the country. So I think saying, oh, well, Boris Johnson, you know, is the Red Wall whisperer. And it's like, well, no, because the public hates him and the Red Wall are the public. So it's not that. That's just a really weird... Yeah.
I just the idea of being whispered to by that guy with his... described to me by somebody as smelling like the back of a watch.
Oh, God.
Yasmin.
Thanks for that.
Where is the... Is there a Red Wall in America or is it just too vast?
There's not a Red Wall that I'm aware of. There is a blue one.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I actually didn't know this until very recently, but the blue wall is what we refer to in the US of like 18 Democratic states. I mean, I think plus DC that have consistently since, say, 1992, always voted Democrat in every presidential election. And this was a term that I believe was coined by my former Atlantic colleague, Ronald Brownstein. Those states, I think if you put them all together, it's like 242 electoral college votes. So he coined it in 2009. But I know when I read about it was when I believe he was writing in 2016 about Hillary Clinton and potentially Trump kind of taking seats. He described it was Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin as being the loosest bricks in that wall.
The loosest bricks in the wall.
And those happen to be the states that Trump won. So he took some of those blue wall seats and then, of course, was elected.
You know what this is? This is the problem. If you've got your colours the wrong way around, it's like having cheese and onion crisps that are blue, right? We've got the red wall and it's Labour. You've got the blue wall and it's Democrats. Very confusing.
It is. We should coordinate more.
We should. Whenever, I mean, the sort of most similar areas, what you're describing there, that I visit is upstate New York, because my family's from around there. Everybody thinks New York, Manhattan and helicopters. It's not like that. It's like poor. It's kind of, you know, clearly that sort of neglected part of America. People are amazing, really lovely. Every front yard has got a Trump poster in it. Is there anything we over here can learn about America's equivalent?
I mean, my only experience in upstate New York was accidentally getting a flat tire en route to a wedding in Vermont,
right?
Which I believe is probably maybe a bit more blue. I'm not sure, but not my side of America. I'm from the definitely blue wall state of California. Yeah. But when we were trying to get the car fixed, we were at a place that was directly across the street from a gun store, classic America. And there were loads of like Trump signs and stuff, which again, if you think to your point, New York, you think that's like kind of classically Democratic stronghold. I think the difference here is that, of course, you know, when you look at the Electoral College map, take Nevada, for example, like it'll be loads of red, but then those little dots of blue that are in the cities. So I think, you know, even when you look at something like labeling something a blue or a red state, oftentimes it can be completely red and just have those little pockets of blue. But to the point that Marie was making, those big pockets of red, it's not like there's loads of people who are being disenfranchised. It's just that there's very few people in those areas outside the cities.
I can't wait to see the Charming Road movie, which is you get a flat tire on the way to a wedding wedding in Vermont.
I'm not going to spoil the ending because that's screenplay.
We'll workshop this one. It's definitely got legs. Hannah, in our red wall, did the Conservatives mistake a one-off vote to make Brexit go away and also to make Jeremy Corbyn go away as a game-changing, life-changing, permanent sea change?
Did they mistake it? I'm not sure they thought of it as anything other than a short-term blip. I don't think they really believed they were going to hang on for decades. They might have hoped so, but I imagine that they could have predicted what's happening now. However, they also mistook not just a vote against Corbyn, against Brexit, everything you mentioned, but also a vote against coalition politics too. People forget, because of this obsession with the term red wall, that some of those constituencies they've never been Conservative, but they weren't permanently Labour. They've been Lib Dem previously, particularly during the coalition years. Redcar is one of those. So it's more of a big sort of FU to the whole system that nothing was working for them and, you know, this was the time to throw it off.
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking beforehand, I was sort of wondering aloud, you know, if the red wall is so important and the Conservatives are, you know, it's so integral to them attempting to maintain some kind of a majority, why haven't they shifted any better talent than what's there at the moment? I mean, it's just a world of Scott Bensons and Lee Andersons.
Yeah. It's not that the Tories are only capable of producing idiots in these areas. It's that they haven't had they haven't invested in those areas. They don't have the local pipeline. They're scared of sort of throwing in London types because they saw what happened in Stoke to Tristram Hunt on Labour. They don't want to repeat those mistakes of putting poshos, you know, from Surrey into important constituents. So they've chosen local people, but often local people who've had no background in politics and have sort of thrown themselves into it as a bit of fun.
I think it's also worth saying that a lot of those MPs won, but were not expected to win at all. And like party, every election will have lots of like weirdos and kind of like, you know, gap fillers in seats they were never expected to win. And then it's like, oh, and like 97 to an extent had a similar thing as well of like lots of Labour MPs going, oh, you're not the sharpest tool in the box. So I think it is partially that as well.
Yeah.
Well, Labour are going to suffer the same thing now. You know, whenever it happens, they're having to find candidates for
everyone.
They all
seem really boring, though. My worry is that actually Labour actually got really terrified looking at the 2019 intake and is now being very careful about selections, which is annoying. I feel like it's quite fun to have a couple of nutters, like also, a smattering of nutters.
The 2017 and 29 intake for Labour were not the most... There was a few absolute clangers in there.
Yeah.
I would say, though, it's quite fun for us, but it's not very fun if that's your constituency MP.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, I mean, you're saying they're going to be quite boring. I'll inject the boring into my veins. I've had quite enough excitement. I'm a fragile person. I cannot deal with much more of this. Marie, we are, you know, the idea that, oh, the Conservatives are abandoning the red wall, terrible, terrible, is central to the Tory rights campaign. to take control of the party. When Danny Kruger and Miriam Cates launched the New Conservatives last November, they said, the Conservative Party now looks like it is deliberately walking away from the coalition of voters who brought us power with a large majority in 2019. Are they right?
So I think they are, but not for the reason they think, in that if you look at the 2019 Conservative offer, what that was actually quite left-wing economically and not very conservative. So lots of state spending, which again, ironically, I think those on the right of the party are entirely allergic to. So when they say, well, we need tax cuts, it's like, no, they don't want tax cuts. Like, they want to be able to see their GP. They want really good public services, but also they just want the state to spend lots of money so their lives are nicer. So I think it is that weird thing where they say, well, you know, we're abandoning the red wall. And it's like, correct. So they're like, so let's abandon them even further. And it's like, no, what? Hang on. So I think, yeah, they're not entirely wrong. The other thing I think worth mentioning as well is that, and as often happens, I think, with a big win, but especially with this one, there's a point at which an electoral coalition just becomes too unwieldy. They built theirs from, you know, Cameron in 2010 and then in Indo in 2015, Theresa May in 2017, obviously Boris in 2019. Like, they built this sort of like Jenga tower with half the pieces already taken out, but that was technically very tall of an electoral coalition. That was never going to last. I think even if they're going to, you know, and then we've had two other prime ministers since then who are hoping to add again, you know, even more. Like, that was never going to work. So there's a point at which it does become a zero sum game. So I you know, you can't please the red wall without pissing off the blue wall. You can't do X without pissing off Y, etc. So I think like the Tories have ended up at this stage where they're probably going to need to just pick something and alienate others, yeah. Which they're clearly sort of unwilling to do. So they're, you know, looking like they're just going to lose everyone instead.
Yeah, just pick a hill and die on it.
No, exactly. Yeah. And they're just a bit like, oh, what if we do a little bit of everything and sort of kind of nothing at the same time? And it's like, great, yeah.
The blue wall's not really a wall so much as a nice little trellis, isn't it, really? Walls are a bit sort of bricky and sort of brutal. Hannah, the Conservatives have been smashing the buttons marked small boats and woke to bits, yep, to no avail. Redfield and Wilson are polling in the red wall and they've got Labour on a steady 20% lead, just like everywhere else. As Marie says, red wall people, they're people. Is there any way for them to turn it around, or has the red wall, like everywhere else, just had it up to here with them, do you think?
I think they've had it up to here with two things. One is obviously the British economy, the cost of living, the reason that everywhere is fed up with them. But they're also fed up of being called the red wall and being told that they're going to be levelled up and everything, and being treated as this kind of weird, quirky thing up north.
Yeah.
And that really grates after a while.
Just to wrap this up, because we're going to be talking about levelling up after the, in the next topic. But Marie, I wanted to ask you about this. Anthony Wells at YouGov says, everyone keeps talking about the red wall seats that the Conservatives won last time, but that may leave them fighting the last war. It's now suburban and semi-rural areas that are actually in play because the Conservatives are such a mess. Are the Conservatives about to make a terrible, terrible misjudgment by thinking that basically putting their troops in the wrong place?
I like that you said that while grinning like the Cheshire Cat. Do you think they're making a terrible mistake?
Threatening myself for the good time, yes.
Yes, but I will say in this slight defence, I think that happens quite often. I would say probably every election, one of the parties just gets hit by a big dose of hubris and is just like, and of course, we will fight, you know, like those seats, etc. And it's like, oh no, my God, like, you could not go for those when you're barely protecting. And I think the problem is, and that's quite often due to the, you know, the party chairman, CCHQ, etc., have to deal with that, or the Labour equivalent. It is really hard to go to MPs who are in quite marginal seats, and not even very marginal seats, and go, I am so sorry, we're not going to spend a single penny on you because we all know you're fucked. So, like, you're on your own. You're not getting volunteers. You're not getting leaflets. Like, you can't. I think it is partially that as well. But like, you just can't abandon too many of your MPs.
Yeah, not even a little bit of Hester money. Not even a tiny soupçon. So, do we think then is Red Wall going to join Mondeo Man and Alarm Clock Britain, and what else did we come up with?
Worcester Woman. Woman, I think definitely. I mean, just the point that Marie made earlier. You know, you're saying about suburban and semi-rural areas. These are actually within the red wall as well. Yeah. And yeah, actually, funnily enough, the comedian Mark Steele was saying to me that when he goes and does his in-town shows in these places, the people who are voting Tory, exactly as Marie said, are people who, because their house prices are not as high, have a much better quality of life than people on similar salaries in the South. And they just become Tory voters. And so the idea that, like, you know, that it's not suburban and semi-rural voters that are in the red wall is farcical.
Yeah, I just wish that lots of the people who moan about the metropolitan elites could just have a quick look at the metropolitan elites' houses. They're like yeah. little boxes. Yeah. We live like hamsters. It's terrible.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Next up, time to choose our hero and villain of the week. Who will be joining Margaret Thatcher, Osama bin Laden, and Hitler in the V&A's Gallery of Villains? They really did this at the V&A, and they got a whole load of stick for it. And who is this week's Kate, Princess of Hearts and Funny-Looking Fingers? We're going to start with Yasmin. Who's your hero of the week, and who's your villain of the week?
My hero of the week is Chef Jose Andreas. Mm. And the reason for that is his charity, the World Central Kitchen, has recently successfully sent a boat from Cyprus to Gaza directly. I think it's the first time that anyone's bypassed the blockade of mm-hmm. Gaza that way and delivered 200 tons of aid.
Wow.
Bad news, it's kind of a drop in the bucket for what they need, but, and it's also completely inefficient with airdrops. However, it was really quite cool to see. And he did that in cooperation, I think, with the UAE and Jordan and stuff like that. Mm. So it wasn't just him, but it was his organization and a really incredible way of doing it. And he's talking a lot about getting more food to the north, which just today was announced is basically may already be in famine. So not just it's on the brink, but it actually may already currently be in a state of famine, according to the IPC. So he's my hero. Villain, I'm going to go with the House of Representatives because they're trying to get rid of TikTok.
All of them?
Yeah. I mean, it's that or Steve Mnuchin, who the former Treasury official Trump, who's said something about trying to get a consortium of people together to buy TikTok. I don't know how I feel about him. I mean, even if it wouldn't be just him having TikTok and Elon Musk having Twitter, I just feel like it's one of the few good social media applications left. Please just leave it alone.
Just as long as you can see a dancing kitten.
I just don't want them to ban it. But then again, I don't live in America anymore, so
yeah,
I'm just fighting for my compatriots from afar, but I'll be okay.
Well, this is Britain's future, is some kind of dark web data haven where you can watch whatever you like because we're not in the EU kind of thing. Okay, Hannah, hero and villain.
Okay, my hero is Banksy, who has popped up and done another nighttime flit. He's done a mural of a tree in Finsbury Park, which is basically a massive, you have to look at it online, I can't really describe, but he's done the sort of leaves of a tree as a massive paint splash behind a cut back stump of a tree. So it looks from a distance as if there's a tree, but when you get close up, you can see it's just a painting. Now, I like it because I've no idea if this is what he meant or not, but it looks a little bit like the Tory oak tree. And I like this idea that from far away, it looks like something, and close up, you realise it's all a complete sham. Ooh. So that, I like that.
Amazing.
My villain is mortgage lenders in general.
We're getting really general today, aren't we? The whole house is
all mortgage lenders. They're all at it. They're all pulling deals after less than 2 weeks of availability, which means that those people who are going through the process of trying to get a mortgage now have to make a decision incredibly quickly before they lose that deal. Obviously, it's a nightmare anyway to buy a house without this. Sometimes people only have hours to make a decision that's going to impact their life for at least probably 5 years, because sometimes longer. And it's just the biggest decision you'll ever make. And to be told you've got 6 hours to make it is just, I think, grim.
Pressure selling.
Yeah.
Incredible. Right. Marie, hero and villain.
So my hero is Level Up, which is a feminist group which had been campaigning to stop pregnant women from going to prison. Mm. And actually, they've succeeded. So as of April the 1st, the guidance from the Sentencing Council for England and Wales is going to be updated, and pregnant women will be less likely to get incarcerated, which is like good news for the woman, but obviously like even better news for the babies. And I think it is one of those feminist causes that's really not very popular. It's not really glamorous or sexy or anything. And, you know, and they're not the idea like women going to prison and not the ideal. So like figureheads are like fighting for feminism, etc. But I think that is such an important issue. And like quite often as well, even pregnant women who go to prison end up in like specific facilities for women and babies. But more often than not, they end up losing custody of the baby. So hopefully that's going to change. And I think, yeah, that's a really, really well done to those campaigners. And my villain is also actually quite general. It's NHS hospitals.
For all of them? Hang on.
Yeah. Well, so according to the NHS Ombudsman, ministers, NHS leaders and hospital boards are doing too little to end the health service deeply ingrained cover-up culture, as well as victimisation of staff who turn into whistleblowers. And that culture, they added, leads to avoidable deaths and families being denied the truth about their loved ones, which I do think, and again, this is maybe another slightly spicy take, that that stuff needs to get talked about. So I remember talking to a lawyer a few years ago who said that quite often he would work with people, you know, who'd had horrible stuff happen to them in NHS hospitals. And we're talking about maybe going to court and suing the hospital for those horrible, terrible things. But then we'd always go, oh, but actually, but you know, it is the NHS. Like, the nurses were lovely, and you know, it is the NHS. And that lawyer being like, no, but like, you know, these are people who suffered from like really traumatic things. But because there's that weird attachment emotionally to the NHS and to like our nurses, they didn't do it, which yeah, I find really frustrating. So I think we need to occasionally move on from that kind of veneration of the institution and look at the fact that, yeah, quite often they do behave quite appallingly.
Okay, it's a tough choice this week. Hero, I'm going to go with Chef Guy with his food delivery, because that's a really important thing that's going to actually save lives immediately, one hopes. Villain, very, very tricky this. I'm sorry, I'm not going to give it to somebody who's getting rid of TikTok. It's only TikTok, man. Come on. I think the villain is, and if I make the NHS hospitals the villain, we will lose all of our Patreon backing, and they'll probably come and burn the studio down as well, the listeners. So I'm going to go for mortgage lenders, because everybody hates those guys, and for making the getting of a mortgage into a very expensive game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
The only way to make the NHS better is to be realistic about its failings.
Okay.
Have you ever thought of going into politics, Marie?
So why exactly is the red wall falling? A big part of that collapse has been the total failure of the Conservatives' much-vaunted levelling up agenda. Boris Johnson promised to rebuild neglected parts of the country in his 2019 election campaign. Not much happened, and the following Prime Minister did not show very much enthusiasm for it either. Now, the Public Accounts Committee has just reported that barely any of its 71 shovel-ready projects that were supposed to be completed this month are on track. Only a tenth of the allotted £10.5 billion of funds has been spent by councils, and only around a third of that £10.5 billion has actually been handed out by Michael Gove's Levelling Up Department. The UK has some of the highest regional inequalities in all 38 OECD countries, not just between London and the South East and the rest of the country, but also between cities and the suburbs and rural areas that surround them. London itself has great wealth alongside some of the worst poverty in the land. Hannah, Levelling Up, it's just been hammered around as a slogan, seemingly has vanished from the agenda since it's been rumbled. What exactly was it supposed to be outside of a slogan?
Okay, it had a bunch of missions, which had clear targets, although some of the targets, to be fair, were quite woolly in the first place. But it was on things that you would imagine: education, skills, health, housing, and these are the kinds of things that it committed to. So on education, that 90% of children would achieve the expected standard of primary reading, writing and maths by 2030. Around skills, 200,000 people a year would receive high skills training to help them get better jobs, and 80,000 of those would be in the lowest skilled areas. That in health, there would be something done around the gap in life expectancy, that it would narrow, and by 2035, healthy life expectancy would rise. That well-being and pride in place would improve, so that everyone was more equal. That by 2030, for private renters in housing, there would be a secure, better standard of housing, so better quality, less mould and damp and all of that. And that would have fallen by 50%, with the biggest improvements in the worst areas. Brackets, the worst areas are London and Birmingham, which are not necessarily places you would think of as levelling up agenda. And the other things you'd imagine, like crime falling and better local leadership and so on. But if you look at like some of the data around this, the gap in life expectancy I mean, that's literally down across the board.
Yeah.
So rather than levelling it up or creating better life chances for people in the most impoverished areas, everybody's in a worse situation. So some of this hasn't happened, not because of a failure of the levelling up agenda specifically, although there are clear failings. It's just because it's a failure to run the country properly at all.
Yeah.
So and what can you do about this kind of stuff when you have a terrible economy?
Yeah, it's hard to do a levelling up agenda when you're actually pursuing a levelling down agenda across the entire, right, the entire country. Is there any evidence that any of it has happened?
Some things have happened. So there has been a better spread of decision-making by taking civil servants out of London. You know, there are better civil service jobs all around the country now. Everybody has access to this kind of devolution deal for local government. Not everybody's chosen to take it up, but there is this kind of broader possibility of making local deals with government. I have strong views about why that's sort of a form of bribery, but nevertheless, that has actually happened. But the problem is, you know, they don't really have anything really exciting to announce because none of it's happened in the time it's supposed to have done.
Well, for the submissions, The Guardian reported that one of the examples given by Gove's team was the extension of a tram line in the West Midlands, and another was giving some money to a college in Northumberland. I mean, not to knock either of those things.
Yeah.
Transport is important, and if you're in the West Midlands, a tram line would be fantastic. Mm. I'm sure if you're at that college in Northumberland, you are delighted as well.
Sure.
But these are not grand things to produce in front of a PAC.
Well, there's the main reason for that is that a lot of the funding allocations are quite small individually. So, you know, if you've got a lot of college grants going out to deliver skills agenda, then that's going to be a small amount of money to all of these colleges. And if there's delays in the programme, which this report finds everything's delayed, then that might actually be doing something quite positive to access to level four education or better skills in that area. But we haven't seen it yet. They can't talk about it because it hasn't come through.
Marie, Gove has been levelling up secretary since 2022. He does have a reputation as probably the most able and the most independent-minded minister. That's one of the reasons why he's sort of semi in his own little fiefdom, sort of slightly in Siberia, isn't he? What does this poor record on levelling up tell us about him?
My understanding from talking to people who know that stuff is that actually the department is busy trying quite hard to do stuff. So especially on the civil service side and the ministers, et cetera, that they are working quite hard. But obviously, you know, that they do need to sign off from number 10 on a lot of stuff. Or they need like energy and money and like stuff from number 10, which they're just not really getting. So I think there's quite a lot of frustration at DLUHC, at the department, because, you know, they could be doing more and they know they could be doing more, but they're not really doing it because, again, like, the impetus does have to come to an extent from the top, like from number 10, and it's not really there. So I'm not convinced it says tons about Gove, but it probably says more about Rishi Sunak.
Did you actually call it DLUHC then?
DLUHC.
DLUHC. Yep. All right.
DLUHC. D-H-L-U-C.
Okay, right.
Which reminds me, was it when it used to be called Locomogo, like, you know, LCMG? And I, in a very serious chat with someone, sorry, it always makes me laugh. And I genuinely said it because I was still trying to get, you know, my head around those letters. And like, in the middle of a really serious sentence, I talked about Loco Homo.
Hey, you've just reminded me of a friend who was doing press for a police force, and her brain got scrambled. And instead of saying that something was under embargo, she said it's under umbongo. This report is under umbongo, and it's stuck to her, I'm afraid. So anyway.
That's truly brilliant.
It is truly brilliant. What's the view of levelling up from within the Tories then, as far as you've heard? Were they ever really committed to it?
So I still remember really clearly a conversation I had with someone who used to work in number 10 in the coalition years. And that was quite early in the Boris time, so it was definitely in 2020. And, you know, and they kind of said, do the Boris people, like, do they really think that we'd not notice there was north-south inequality? Or like, do they think that we didn't want to fix it? And do you think that, no, any government in the past 30, 40 years had, yeah, either not noticed it or decided not to fix it? And it was a bit like, you know, they were saying, it's a thing where A, it's about 1 million problems in one. B, it needs a lot of investment to fix. And C, anything we do would take a long time. And then I remember like that, having that incredibly sort of like frustrated conversation with that former advisor who was like, no, but like, every government has tried. It's not just that we didn't want it enough, like in a fucking like kids book.
Yeah.
So I do think they cared about it. But yeah, there was certainly some frustration there with them being like, and we're going to do it because no one else had come up with the idea before, saying, well, the North should not be poorer than the South.
It's actually in one, it's both the perfect and the absolute worst Boris Johnson project, isn't it? It's perfect because it's like, I'll just build a load of stuff and I can run around with my stupid hat on and I can drive bulldozers and all this caper. But actually, you don't fix it that way. It's a details issue. Yeah. And what are you, Boris? You're not a details person, are you? I don't know. I can't remember. Am I? Am I not? No, you're not a details person. So it's both perfect and the worst of the lot.
It is.
Yasmin, rebuilding the left behind, you know, be it here, be it the Rust Belt, be it, you know, the places Trump talked about, from a certain angle, it is the theme of politics in the 2020s, isn't it? You know, going to the places that have been neglected for years and fixing them and binding them to you politically forever. It's a huge part of Trump's appeal. Biden has even tried to do it under the Inflation Reduction Act, under the guise of that. What does it do to trust in governments when, you know, they promise things so clearly and then don't deliver them so clearly?
I mean, to the point that Marie was making, I mean, even if you look at something like Inflation Reduction Act and kind of all the big sort of ambitious things that Biden is trying to do, I mean, a lot of these things, you know, changing the built environment, like these projects can be very slow going. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one thing to promise it in a campaign and to pass this like massive legislation, but then you have to deal with, and I mean, I don't even know like the ins and outs of like all these particular things, but like, you know, some things might be going well, some things might not, but like, I mean, these are not things that you're going to achieve. You know, building back better is great. Building back faster, however, is like kind of more difficult, and it's not something you can like achieve, I think, in 4 years. So it's tricky. They're saying the right things, but I think actually, to Marie's point, implementing them proves quite a lot harder. I mean, I think in terms of its impact on trust, I mean, I was even just taking a look at the polling because I was interested and saying like, you know, like what, where's the state of like trust in America and how has it changed? And what's like, there was a little bit of an uptick in 2020 and 2021. You can maybe imagine why our democracy was on the line. And they were like, oh, great. Okay, everything's fine. But it's actually sunk back down again to as low as like 15%, I think, in average. I mean, I looked at the UK figures and that's actually quite similar in terms of trust in Parliament. It's about like kind of like low 20s. So I think it's the case where I think it's almost maybe a vicious circle where people already didn't have a lot of trust in government. These parties come in and make all these grand plans and either they fail to implement them or don't implement them fast enough. And it's just, but I mean, I think what polls also show, which isn't particularly surprising, is people's trust in government, especially in this sort of partisan era that we're in, tends to be higher when your party of choice is in power. So I think a lot depends on, you know, kind of A, the sort of how partisan are things, and are you just happy when your people are kind of in charge and you're willing to cut them a bit more slack? Yeah. Or is it the case that you already didn't have trust in them and it's just very difficult to do these things? And if they can't achieve them quickly, it goes further down.
I mean, the intensely frustrating thing for the Democrats is that objectively, Biden's doing quite a good job on the economy. The economy's in great shape. And you would not know this at all from the polls or in the way it's reported. He's getting absolutely no credit. We were told incessantly, it's the economy, stupid. Well, here's the economy and nobody cares.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point. I mean, I think a lot of it is also lived experience. I mean, I haven't lived in the U.S. for quite some time. Yeah. I know that grocery prices are also a thing, apparently. But yeah, at the end of the day, the U.S. is so terribly divided. I mean, the thing is, 2020, saving democracy was really compelling, made even more compelling after January 6th. Unfortunately, this seems to be more of a kind of traditional campaign, and this time Biden's fighting it as an incumbent. And so even to your point, if it's right that the economy is actually going quite well, and he has a lot of good things to point to, he's still defending a record against someone who, well...
who's offering all kinds of fantasy stuff. Hannah, a railway question, because you like railways. Pulling HS2 was one of the biggest embarrassments of this government. It seemed to be a really clear message that the North just doesn't count. Is it too late for any Conservative government to persuade voters that levelling up was real and not just a slogan? I mean, the clock is almost run out.
Well, I think it's too late for a couple of reasons, because it's not just about levelling up. It's that, yes, levelling up was just a slogan, or it was promised too much too soon that it could ever deliver. But then so was the Northern Powerhouse under Osborne, and that failed to deliver too. Yeah. So it's like a double record of failing.
Every time I
Who remembers the Midlands engine? Sajid Javid's baby. Because I do.
Wasn't that just an episode of Thomas the Tank Engine? You just made that up. In Northern Powerhouse, you mentioned that. Every time I pull into Lime Street Station in Liverpool, there's a train there with Northern Powerhouse on the side, and you see people on the train going, what the fuck is that thing?
Well, and nobody remembers. Nobody and then remembers. The other thing that's a slogan as well is shovel ready, because that's been, you know, thrown in front of every single one of these. And the reality is the shovels weren't ready, and that's why none of it's come to fruition. So it's all sloganeering, and none of it was facing reality. The interesting thing about levelling up, though, is everybody's conflating it with the Red Wall, but actually it was a much broader policy. So Tim Farron has recently been criticising the government for focusing some of their investment on housing around Barking and around Canary Wharf, which has obviously changed massively post-pandemic because none of the bankers have come back to work. I think he's completely wrong about that, because Poplar and Barking are among the most deprived areas in the country, and the whole point of levelling up wasn't supposed to be like, let's sort the Red Wall. It was supposed to look at these pockets of deprivation where they exist and make sure there's equal opportunity everywhere. So I think that it's frustrating to watch the criticism be conflated with all the problems that the government got in the Red Wall as well.
Yeah, it's really stark when you, if you ever visit the Isle of Dogs, when you come to the top of the Isle of Dogs and you cross the big motorway, you basically, it's like, look right, capitalism is pumping and glowing and everything's made of glass. Look left and it looks like the 1930s.
Absolutely. But on top of that as well, the capitalism that was once pumping and primed and amazing. Yeah. I went to meet an editor for lunch in Canary Wharf the other week, and it was on a Monday lunchtime, and the place was absolutely deserted. Mm. The restaurants were empty. So that whole area is going to have a complete rethink post the whole working from home hybrid situation.
This town is coming like a ghost town. Pret-a-Manger has been closed down. Finally, Marie, are you expecting much better from Labour?
Yes and no. So I think yes, in the sense that surely it can't be hard to have a number 10 operation that's a bit more willing to do things. But at the same time, there's not a ton of money about. And it does seem that this version of the Labour Party seems incredibly cautious about any kind of spending, even on stuff like infrastructure, which is not ideal. So yes, I would say yes, it will get better from a low bar.
Things can only get better.
Hello, I'm Dorian Lynskey.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm in 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
We've reached the end of the show. It's time for Escape Routes. What books, films, TV and similar have been taking our minds off the boiling hell that is the outside world. Marie.
I am reading at the moment a non-fiction book. I'm normally very much a novel gal, but no, I picked this up quite randomly. But it's really fun. So it's How Iceland Changed the World by, I'm going to butcher this so bad, Egil Bjarnason. And it's really fun. So, the subtitle is The Big History of a Small Island. And it's kind of, it's both a history of Iceland as a country, but also looking at all the ways in which it's kind of influenced the rest of the world in ways we may not know about. And it's really interesting. And also, I would say, incredibly easy to read. I have no attention span, which is why I don't really read nonfiction, because I can't really do dry books. Mm. And this is really fun. I think even like actually one of the strap lines is, the book might be about a cold place, but it's tailor-made to be read on the beach.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. So it's, yeah, a nice combination of like learning lots of stuff, but also in a way that's like easy on the brain.
How Iceland Changed the World by, I'm not going to try and pronounce that name. Is Björk in it yet?
No, not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
No, well, we're still in the 19th century, that where I'm at currently.
She'll be in it at the end, I would have thought. Mm. Yasmin, what have you been distracting yourself with?
I'm kind of torn between two. Can I do two?
Yeah.
So I just finished this series called Masters of Air. I think it was Steven Spielberg. It's like these U.S. Army officers in World War II. It has Austin Butler and a bunch of other people. I get really confused because I feel like Austin Butler's everywhere now. So I see him as like in Dune is like, that's, I forget his name now, but that scary looking thing. Yes. And then in this, I much more fun to watch in this program. But anyway, very, very good. And then the other thing, because I feel like I come to cultural things very late, Masters of Air probably being the only exception, I've only just started watching the show Rami, which is about a kind of first generation Arab American Muslim kid growing up in New Jersey. It's hysterical. It's stars Rami Youssef. And it's just this hilarious, especially around Ramadan, which I think the show at one point describes as Coachella for Muslims, which is beautiful. It just kind of caricatures, but in a really fun, sometimes exaggerated, but sometimes painfully accurate way, kind of a typical first generation Arab American family. Rami Youssef's in it is great. Hayam Abbas, who's this Palestinian actress, is also wonderful in it. It's just very, very good. So.
And what's it on?
So that's the fun, tricky bit. It was on Hulu in the States. I coughed up a considerable amount of money to watch on Apple TV. I think you can like buy the two seasons. Mm. There's a third season. And Rami, if you're listening, I hope. There is a third season that was out as of 2022, but is inaccessible in this country, which is confounding me. So I'm trying to find workarounds, VPNs, etc. I'm working on it.
I can send you some dodgy links.
Oh, sounds good. Hannah?
I am reading Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver, which is fantastic.
It's brilliant, isn't
it? A retelling of David Copperfield, but in the Appalachian Mountains, in, well, say current day, but obviously he's born in, like, I think the early 80s. So it starts in the early 80s when the main character is born. It's a fascinating, I mean, it's not really moving away from modern politics, is it? Because it's a fascinating...
No, it's absolutely embedded in modern politics, yeah.
It's a fascinating exploration of, you know, the left behind in modern America. And I've actually been to the Appalachians. I grew up with a dad who's incredibly into country and bluegrass. So I've been to that area and I see exactly the community. I've seen the community talking about, and it's, but it's so perfect. And there's one sort of sentence or like just form of words from the early chapters that I just wanted to share with everyone, describing the monster truck mud rally of child services, which is such a perfect description for how, you know, child protection can actually behave. And I think that's true in this country too, let's be honest. And I just thought it was such a great term. I had to write it down.
I love this book. I'm buying it.
I haven't finished yet, but it's so brilliant.
I keep buying it to give to people for presents because it's just so fantastic. Well, mine is a documentary that was on BBC Four on Friday and is still on the iPlayer, and it's called Micro Disney, The Clock Comes Down the Stairs. And it is the story of a fantastic Irish band who you may not have heard of, probably haven't heard of. They sort of emerged in Ireland in the 1980s, but John Peel was a huge fan. What they did was they kind of married really harsh, cruel, extremely black humour and very dark lyrics to beautiful lilting melodies, the likes of which sort of crossed, you know, between Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys and Esquivel and so on. You know, some of it sounded like lounge music, some of it sounded like pop music, some of it sounded like a nervous breakdown. Cardle Coughlin, who was the singer, passed away a couple of years ago. He was a Patreon supporter of this show, and when I got that email saying that he supported the show, I could not believe it, because he'd always been a hero of mine. Also, Sean O'Hagan, who's the other half of the songwriting duo, is also a supporter. And this film tells their story right up to the reunion shows in 2018, which were some of the greatest things I've ever seen live. It's really good. It's really moving. I love the stories of people who never quite make it, but never give up. They keep going. They do split in the end. They go off to do other musical things, but there's a reunion that is, like I say, quite touching, and I recommend it. I'll put a link to the iPlayer thing in the show notes, and I might make a little playlist as well in case it turns people onto the brilliance that was Micro Disney, who deserved to be properly remembered. And that's the end of the Tuesday edition of Oh God, What Now? Thank you, Yasmin.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Marie.
Thank you.
And thank you, Hannah.
Thank you.
Oh God, What Now? We'll be back on Thursday for our Patreon backers and Friday morning for everybody else. Don't forget, it's not time to put your clocks forward yet, but it is time to put your Patreon backing up. If everybody on the £2 tier went up to the £3 tier instead, it would make a huge difference of a great deal of money to us, and it would help us keep the lights on. So follow the link in the show notes and upgrade right now. And if you join Patreon, you will get a shout out from the panel like these.
Hello, and many thanks for your support to Chris Hick, Claire and Nick Loss.
Bienvenue et merci beaucoup pour votre soutien à Chris Stevens, Natalie Taylor and Matt Legg.
Hello, welcome aboard, and a big thank you from me to James Wise, Daniel and Rick Allen.
And finally, a big shout out from me, and thanks for helping us to pay the rent to Daniel Wright and returning supporters. Welcome back to Lee Brookshaw and Jonathan Spence. We will see you next time. This show is under on Bongo.
Oh God, What Now? Was presented by Andrew Harrison with Hannah Fern, Marie LeConte and Yasmin Sirhan. It was produced by Chris Jones with audio production by Robin Leburn, video production by Chris Jones and art by Jim Parrott. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production.